Welcome to Great Australian Lives.
For Tobin Brothers Funerals,
celebrating lives. Here's your host, Laura Turner.
Hello and welcome to another special edition of Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. I'm Laura Turner. Our guest tonight is going to take us into the world of biochemistry and pharmacology. And while he might spend a lot of time in the lab on his research projects, there are real-world implications for his work. He and his team have just been awarded a Faye Williams Innovation Grant worth $375,000, which will further research into new drug treatments for Alzheimer's. With just under 500,000 Aussies living with dementia, it is important work that will improve the lives of so many Australians. Welcome to Great Australian Lives, Professor Michael Parker from St Vincent's Institute of Medical Research. How are you, Professor?
Thank you very much. Please call me Michael.
Now, congratulations on the grant, first of all. As we will learn in this show, this sort of funding is crucial for your work, isn't it?
Oh, it is. I think generally, funding in Australia is very difficult at the moment. We haven't had a growth in our medical research funding for many, many years. Particularly in the areas that I work in, particularly dementia and Alzheimer's disease, the bodies that are most likely to fund our work are philanthropic bodies. Because we're doing very high-risk work, we don't know where it's going to go, but we're trying to translate our discoveries.
Tell me a little bit about the research project that was awarded and why do you think it was the winner of the funding?
Yeah, it was amazing. It's a very competitive process. I think only two out of about 40 grants were awarded. And I think they're looking for very innovative approaches to Alzheimer's disease. And our approach using different types of methods is to look at inflammation in the brain. So with dementia, and Alzheimer's disease is one of the major dementias, you do get a response in the brain to the plaques that form in Alzheimer's disease. You get an inflammation occurring, and that can damage neurons, brain cells, and cause a lot of damage. So we're actually have approaches to try to use those immune cells in the brain, which are called microglia, to actually attack the toxins caused by Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's, and so on. And hopefully that will at least be a treatment in the future.
Fascinating stuff. I don't even know where to begin with the sort of work you do. It is just, it's incredible, mind-blowing, really. Now, as we know about Alzheimer's, 487,500 Australians living with dementia and almost 1.6 million Australians involved in the care of those people. Those are really big numbers. I want to make sure we get it right because dementia and Alzheimer's are two different things, aren't they?
Dementia is a description of a number of over a dozen different diseases, and Alzheimer's is one of them. So Alzheimer's, like my recollection is about 70% of dementias are Alzheimer's. But when you look at the different diseases in dementia, they've all got a sort of a common thread of a protein that converts into a toxic form that causes the disease.
It is a devastating disease, isn't it?
Yeah, I think we've all probably know relations that have been through this. Certainly in my family, I can think of my wife's father and mother passed away from dementia. So I've seen the effects directly.
Yeah. For you, I mean, for all of us, as you mentioned, everyone knows someone. For you particularly, though, watching someone go through it, I mean, knowing what you know and how close you get to, you know, certain discoveries and that sort of thing, it must be very frustrating to watch.
It is very frustrating. I think you sort of put the science aside and you have that emotional side with the family that are suffering from that. I'm pretty realistic on the sort of scientific side, knowing that diseases particularly that affect the brain, it is so difficult to do that research for many obvious reasons, I think. So it's frustrating. We're not getting as far as we'd like, but we're dealing with something that's very difficult to tackle.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned sort of toxins before in the brain and the proteins. Can you explain to me what we can do to sort of stave it off, I guess? I mean, how do we clear the toxins in our brains? Or can we?
Yeah, well, that's a field of active research. So the whole field of neuroinflammation is not that old. And what we know is that these immune cells in the brain do try to attack these toxins, but in dementias like Alzheimer's disease, you just get too much of the toxic protein. So this particular project we're being funded for is trying to activate more the immune cells, the microglia cells, to attack these toxic molecules and clear them from the brain.
Wow. As we mentioned before, it's so devastating. And is there any way that you can see it coming, or genetics obviously play a role?
Oh, it's a really interesting question and a tough one. So with genetics, it turns out that only about 4% of people that get Alzheimer's disease, there's a clear genetic basis for it. And we know the proteins involved in that. And I think the evidence is incredibly strong for the hereditary forms of Alzheimer's disease that it's due to these particular proteins that have got mutations in them. But that leaves obviously about 95% that there's not a clear genetic basis, and there could be all sorts of reasons. Where the big problem in the field is that there's a logical step from the hereditary form to the non-hereditary form, in that some people say that we know the causes of the hereditary form, therefore it probably is the same cause for the non-hereditary forms. And there's a huge debate in the community for decades about whether that's true or not. There is a theory out there which I'm getting more interested in, and I think there's some support for it. And so a lot of people think these toxic molecules, something's gone wrong with the brain. I have a feeling what it is, and there's a bit of evidence for this, is that when we get attacked by bacteria and viruses, these immune cells are actually part of trying to protect us. So when viruses like COVID get into the brain, these cells get activated. The breakdown in Alzheimer's disease actually has antibacterial and antiviral properties. So it could actually be a natural thing that, so if we get attacked by viruses and bacteria, you get a lot of these toxic molecules being made because they're toxic to the bacteria and the viruses, but also toxic to us. So that's a theory, but it would explain the non-hereditary form. And that's unlucky. If you just happen to get a bacterial infection that gets to the brain, then that could occur.
Well, I was going to ask, does that mean that, this could be a very basic question from a non-sciencey person, but does that mean that, could it be that the sicker you've been in your life, the sicker you've been in your life, the more susceptible you are to this non-hereditary side of it?
I don't think I've seen evidence of that. It may or may not be true. There's certainly some sort of social science evidence of if you have an occupation where you use your brain a lot, or perhaps you do crossword puzzles, etc., there might be a link between use of your brain and getting this. Getting back to your early question there, who gets and when do they get it? That has been a big problem in the field. So we're just getting the ways of diagnosing whether people have got the disease at the moment. But it looks like probably if you're going to get Alzheimer's disease, the normal form of it, you get it in your 30s. So you actually start displaying the symptoms when you're in your 50s. One of the big challenges in the field is to determine when people start getting the disease. And there's been some breakthroughs in diagnostics of the disease over the last few years. It looks like we do get Alzheimer's in our 30s, but we don't actually see the symptoms until you get into your 50s. That causes a real problem. So in the clinical trials, the drugs haven't been working. And it could well be that we're giving it to people when they've got their symptoms, but not when they've actually started to get the disease. So the drugs could be 20 years too late.
So is there any way of knowing, I mean, this is probably the million-dollar question, of who's got it in their 30s?
Yes. So there's academics and industry all around the world trying to develop diagnostics that can actually be able to work out whether people in their 30s have got it. You can sort of backtrack from some of the pathology that it must be people in their 30s that start to get the disease then.
Is there any sign, anything that would set one 30-year-old apart from another that you know of yet?
None at all.
Great. Not helpful, is that? Wow. Well, we'll go to a break now. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives. Our guest tonight is Professor of Biochemistry and Pharmacology, Michael Parker, and more with him in just a moment.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives. I'm Laura Turner. Our guest tonight is Professor Michael Parker from St Vincent's Institute of Medical Research, one of two recipients of a Faye Williams Innovation Grant, each worth $375,000, which will further his research into new drug treatments for Alzheimer's. And we know how important these sorts of grants and donations are in the field of science. Some people might not be aware, but it can be make or break for some research projects. Now, Professor Michael Parker, we've spoken a little bit about your research, but I want to know about you. What makes an incredible person such as yourself? You were born in Manly and grew up in the 60s and 70s on the Collaroy Plateau in Sydney. Was it a typical sort of sun, beach and sport young professor running around on Sydney's beaches?
Yeah, look, exactly right. And I think important to say that scientists are just like every other person, and it's just not the individual too. It's always about teams and stuff. So my early life was just typical for a kid growing up in northern suburbs of Sydney. Absolutely loved sport, played a lot of sport. My recollection was lots of sun up in Sydney, not so much in Melbourne, but so it was a really normal sort of life.
Yeah, and you, I know, still have your first toy microscope. So there must have been stars in your eyes in terms of the world of science when you were a little boy.
Yeah, I've still got that microscope, and I know it had a big impression on me, and I just think maybe that had an effect. And it reminds me, I've actually got a number of roles. So I'm also, as well as a researcher at St Vincent's, I'm also director of a medical research institute called Bio21. And we've got a new building which will open soon, but it's named after a famous Australian scientist, Ruth Bishop, and her collaborator, Ian Holmes. Ruth is famous for discovering a virus called rotavirus, which killed millions of children around the world. And the big breakthrough for her was going to Ian and seeing whether the virus caused these diarrhea disease that kids have, and then using electron microscopes could see it. So just behind me in my office here, Ruth and Ian have passed away, but their families are giving me some of their keepsakes for a little museum, and they've both got little microscopes. I've got those.
Oh,
so maybe if you want to grow up, maybe you need a toy microscope when you're little.
That's very telling. I know all of my children, when they've been vaccinated, they get that rotavirus vaccine. I think it's a live. Is that the live one that they get on there in orally?
Yeah, I haven't really followed that. The rotavirus is.
I think it is.
A vaccine's been developed over many years, so I haven't tracked where it is at the moment.
Anyway, you just jog my memory of days of screaming children in child health centres. But anyway, now more about you, Professor. You had a pretty traditional family upbringing, didn't you? Your parents sort of instilled work ethic, determination, competitiveness. And I know that you said when you provided some sort of background for us that one of the things your parents instilled in you was overcoming disappointment. I mean, I know in science there is a lot of disappointment. Do you sort of call on those qualities from your parents when a project fails?
You do, but at my stage of my career, I mentor a lot of younger scientists. When they're starting out, they're not used to this. So there's a lot of mentoring about how it actually works. So we have that. I mean, examples would be grant results. Another example would be scientific results where your hopes are up high and then you get a decision which could be fantastic and you get that elation. Or more often than not, it tends to be things haven't worked. And you go through a period where you're pretty unhappy and then you sort of pick yourself up and you try again. So I think all successful scientists, they need to have that quality of dealing with disappointment and then keeping on going.
That's the thing, isn't it? I mean, with the public, we hear about great breakthroughs and, you know, developments in the scientific world, but behind closed doors, I'm sure it would be never-ending frustrations with certain things, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it's rare that a project would be a few weeks or a few months. Normally projects are a few years, and the really challenging projects could be many, many years. I think from the public there's this feeling that there seems to be discoveries every day. That's not actually what we have in the lab. We'll have our one discovery every 1 or 2 years, and if it's relevant, then public will get to hear about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, tell me about protein crystallography. Have I pronounced it correctly? the late 70s, you were at the ANU doing honours and you were introduced to the world of protein crystallography. A, have I said that right? And B, what is it?
You've said it right. So the way I'd like to answer that question is actually going back to the start of crystallography, which was really in Adelaide. A professor of physics, William Bragg, was invited to come from England to head the Department of Physics. And he had children in Adelaide, and one of them was Lawrence Bragg. And then Lawrence went to the University of Adelaide, and his father got a offer of a job in the UK again, and Lawrence went with him and ended up at the University of Cambridge in his early 20s. So he can finish off his university degree. And he was sent a photograph of a German guy shot X-rays at a crystal and got all these spots on a piece of film. And so sent them to Lawrence Bragg at Cambridge. And he could see straight away that he could develop a very simple mathematical equation to convert those spots into a chemical structure. And for that, he got a Nobel Prize, as did his father. Up until about 10 years ago, he was the youngest Nobel Prize winner, and he was Australia's first Nobel Prize winner. But it took 30 years for the first protein structures, and very importantly, in that same time with the first protein structures, was the first structure of DNA using the same sort of method. So we're really very familiar, I think, with the double helix that came from this method. Wow. So shining X-rays, in that case, it was sort of fibres of DNA. We use crystals because if we try to shine X-rays at one molecule, you don't get any signal. So the crystals are just a repeat of thousands of molecules. So it amplifies a signal and we can convert it into a structure. So since Bragg's Nobel Prize, there's been about 40 Nobel Prizes in protein crystallography. So it's been a very impactful field.
I was going to say, pivotal, really, in terms of, you know, as you say, and so impactful, significant to the world of science and these developments that we have seen, we, the public, who have no idea what's going on behind closed lab doors, but all really important stuff. You went to Oxford University, didn't you, and ended up in Germany. That must have been a fascinating experience over at Oxford.
It was. Well, for many reasons, and I'd certainly for anyone, but particularly scientists going overseas, if they're going to a PhD or postdoctoral work, is a fantastic experience, just seeing life in another country and seeing how our science operates. For me, I was very fortunate because the founders of the protein crystallography field were still alive, and a lot of them were at Oxford, so I got to meet them and actually heard how those very first structures were done. So that's very... very inspiring. I guess one of the most famous crystallographers is a woman called Dorothy Hodgkin, who famous for getting the structures of vitamin B12 and then insulin after that. And so these structures, so the X-ray crystallography is pretty much a microscope. But to see atoms, you need X-rays because the wavelength has got to be quite small to see atoms. And so once we get these structures, though, they're very important for doing drug discovery. So a lot of crystallographers these days are involved in drugs. So when you hear new drugs come out, when the public hear about that, quite often crystallography has been involved in the development of those drugs.
Fascinating stuff. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives. Our guest tonight is Professor Michael Parker, and more with him in just a moment.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funeral, Celebrating Lives. Our guest tonight is Professor Michael Parker from St Vincent's Institute of Medical Research, whose focus at the moment is new and innovative drug treatments for Alzheimer's. First of all, Professor, am I saying that right? I know I've heard it Alzheimer's and Alzheimer's, and how do you say it?
Well, I'd actually say Alzheimer's.
Don't tell me you don't even know.
Well, it is. So where it comes from is in 1901, a German doctor, Alois Alzheimer, had a patient with dementia. In those days, when people got dementia, they went to an asylum, locked people away.
Yeah.
So this patient died, and he looked at her brain tissue and saw the what we now know as plaques and tangles in the brain. So that was 1901, so a long, long time ago. And so the debate ever since is whether those plaques and tangles are the cause of the disease or sort of a pathology of the disease. And that sort of debate continues to today.
Now, before, I think it was the first segment, you alluded to the difficulty in doing research for this disease. I mean, obviously when someone passes away, if you're lucky enough to get a hold of their brain, you have it there. But in terms of those living with the disease, what can you gain from them?
Oh, look, I think one of the important things, there's a couple of important things. One of them is, which we talked about before, is diagnostics of being able to see whether we can see something in the blood particularly, but other tissues, well, when people are alive, whether we can see evidence of the disease. So that means you're comparing patients that we know have got the disease with patients which we think are healthy. But the other obvious thing is the clinical trials, is that it is very important that we do have enough patients to test the drugs that we're developing to see if they really work.
God, it's a long, hard road. How do you keep yourself, you know, focused? And I guess these are characteristics of yours anyway, because you're a scientist. But being focused and motivated in such a difficult and, I'm sure, frustrating field, is that hard for you?
No, it's again from. What we said earlier is tend to be very competitive, whether it's sport or whatever. And so we've still got that very competitive spirit. I think the other thing too is I get a lot of pleasure out of mentoring students and young early career researchers, and seeing them have success is a really wonderful feeling. So it's not just about the science, it's about the people you're training as well.
And speaking of which, can you tell me what the current state of science and research in Australia is like at the moment? Is this a good country to be doing your work in? I know funding is hard at the moment, at times tougher than they've been in your field.
Yeah, it is incredibly tough at the moment. We have three main government bodies of funding: the Australian Research Council, which funds all sorts of things, not just science, but other things, but very basic discovery. And its amount of money that it gives out each year hasn't really increased over a decade. And then for medical research, we've got National Health Medical Research Council. And again, their money has increased over 10 years, but the number of scientists have increased. And also the technology, a tremendous amount of technology now, and it's all very expensive. And so the costs have increased, but the grants are still there. And the only one where there has been a big bonus has been the Medical Research Future Fund, and that's certainly got a lot of money in it. It's a fund set up by Tony Abbott's government a few years ago, quite a few years ago now, and it's got a lot of money in it, but it's very directed towards clinical research and health research, and that is an area that was totally underfunded. So that is a positive, but for people who are trying to understand how the body works and do those first few steps to developing drugs, it is very, very, very tough at the moment.
Yeah, sounds like it. You mentioned that you've got a lot of young scientists coming through. Why do you think that has increased, given how hard it is to do the job?
It's probably going back to being my microscope. I think they've all the young scientists have got stars in their eyes, and I certainly want to encourage that. But the other thing, and I don't know whether it's just me, but my three new students, one comes from Greece, one comes from India, and another one just about comes from China. So they're all international students. So whether that says something about Australian science, I'm not sure. But it's very important for Australian science that we're part of the international community. And these networks, even with the students, are very important for science in Australia. Mm.
And is Melbourne is a hub for medical research, isn't it? There's the new mRNA vaccine centre coming. Would you say, would Melbourne lead Australia in these sorts of fields?
I am very proud Melbourneian, even though I grew up in Sydney.
Why did you laugh?
Well, it's a bit of a conflict, but no, I do love Melbourne. But the Parkville Biomedical Precinct, so Bio21 is in there, and the SBI is a little bit further out. It is just an amazing precinct. So I'm at Bio21 at the moment, and next to me is the Royal Women's, the Royal Melbourne, and then there's the Royal Children's just up the road. And then we've got all those great medical research institutes. Our sister institute is the Doherty Institute. And across from the Doherty is the Peter Mac and the VCCC. We've got WEHI across the road.
Big names.
So it turns out if you look at biomedical precincts around the world, the Parkville one is in the top five. In terms of breakthroughs and so on, where we sort of fail in a bit is just on that translational side of industry, which is still fairly small in Australia.
What does that mean, translational side of industry?
Yeah, so when we try to translate our results, so we'll discover a molecule, we'll discover a drug-like molecule, we'll make sure it's safe and everything, and then it will go into human clinical trials. That requires a lot of money, and you need an industry partner, so a pharmaceutical partner, to take it through clinical trials. And so a lot of those pharmaceutical partners are overseas. We've got one big one, which we're very proud of, with the CSL. But we need more CSLs to really make something of all the basic discoveries we make in Melbourne and Australia.
Now, I want to know from you, Professor Michael Parker, if someone came to you and said, I have all the money in the world to fund a project for you, all the resources, any equipment or lab that you want, what would it be that you would research?
Oh, boy, let's say a big one. I should preface this by saying that I work in three different fields. Protein crystallography is a tool, but I work in cancer, and we've got some big breakthroughs there in dementias and also in infection. And we do work on the coronavirus as well, so I've got a drug we're trying to develop there. I know, I think I'd probably, if it's to do with the project, the real passionate part is Alzheimer's disease, because it's so untreatable. If it was something to try and get all those different diseases to solve a lot of problems, then they'd probably be investing in technology just to make it faster and getting those partnerships with industry.
Imagine if that could happen for you. I mean, I'm sure there's been times in your job where you thought, oh, if we just had this or we just had that. I mean, have you found yourself held back?
Oh, definitely. I think one of the big problems I've had so I was overseas for 10 years, came back to Australia, is that the grants tend to be for 3 years, up to 3 years. It's very hard to get grants longer. Whereas when I was in Europe, you can get 10-year grants. And when you get 10-year grants, you can actually tackle the really difficult problems, knowing there's not an expectation you're going to get a result in the first few years. And just on that point about the money, I did have that feeling a few days ago, because a very famous research institute, medical research institute in London, the Francis Crick Institute, there was an announcement of a billion pounds, from Wellcome Trust and Cancer Research UK going to this institute. So over $1 billion. So boy, does that make a difference.
Over £1 billion. That's insane. Imagine that. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Our guest tonight is Professor Michael Parker, and we'll wrap things up with him in just a moment.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. I'm Laura Turner. Our guest tonight is Professor Michael Parker from St Vincent's Institute of Medical Research, one of two recipients of a Faye Williams Innovation Grant, each worth $375,000, which will further his research into new drug treatments for Alzheimer's. And we know how much those grants, or how important those grants are to scientific and medical research. Philanthropy in science, Professor Michael Parker. The Dementia Australia Research Foundation acknowledges Faye Williams, whose generous donation funded the research grants. When those grants come up, do you get excited? I mean, we've talked over and over about how imperative they are to your work. I mean, would you survive without them?
No, and I think an aspect we haven't talked about is what do these grants fund? So obviously they fund reagents to do your work, but the majority of it funds people. And so my Alzheimer's group at SVI consists of four people, so it's not a very big team, and they're funded on grants. And those, as I said before, those grants may only go 3 years. So that's another part of the life of a scientist, that you're on this temporary money all the time. And even myself, up until recently, until I had this second role at the University of Melbourne, since coming back to Australia, my salary has been funded by fellowships, and they're five-year fellowships. So I've had about five or six of those. So there's, you don't have that stability.
Yeah, I was just thinking that that's a difficult existence. The work you do is so important, but not having that financial, not knowing that the check, the check's coming in always. So how does it work for you? Do you have to put your hand up for these sorts of jobs, or like, how do you find yourself having gotten into a 5-year?
Yeah, so with regards to the fellowships, they're competitive, so their success rates are about 20%. I think people understand what you need to do to be able to attract those fellowships, so it's a lot of hard work. In terms of the team, you can't apply just one grant. You've got to apply for a number of grants, and that's why we've got a number of different projects. So if one project isn't funded, then I can shift people onto another project.
So do you have a person in the corner banging out applications for grants every day, so you're never running out?
A lot of it I still have to do myself. There's so many tricks. It's called grantsmanship to try and write a grant, but I do have a lab manager who helps with some of the grants too.
Yeah, I can imagine. Well, I know there are. Yeah, there's certain ways you've got to apply and things you've got to say. Philanthropic donations. I know it's a really hard time at the moment, especially post-COVID. There's been so many industries hit financially. Are you finding that is waning?
It is certainly the last couple of years. Philanthropic funding has been very difficult for everybody. One thing I'd note is that overseas, there's some big philanthropic funds. So in the UK, there's the Wellcome Trust, which funds, I think, about 50% of medical research in the UK. And then in the States, there's the Gates Foundation and the Howard Hughes. So these are, billionaires. We don't have someone who's put up their hand in Australia, which, boy, would that make a difference if we had the equivalent of the Wellcome Trust in Australia.
For those listening tonight, Michael Parker, who, have loved ones with dementia and Alzheimer's, what can you say to them? What sort of hope is there on the horizon in terms of research?
The numbers of researchers in the field have exploded. There's an enormous amount, and there's a lot of new ways of looking at the disease. We've seen with COVID, actually, we've seen the mRNA technology come to the fore. Just on that, if it wasn't for COVID, people thought that was too experimental. They weren't prepared to look at that in clinical trials. And because of COVID, the urgency, it was approved to go into clinical trials. It's proven to be a fantastic approach to drug discovery. So there's a lot of new approaches for drug discovery. I'm involved in some of those, where understanding the disease in terms of all the molecules involved in the disease at a lot more detail. So I think there's definitely a lot of hope there. Unfortunately, I've always said when I got started in the Alzheimer's field in the 90s, is that we'll probably understand what causes the disease when we find the drug. So hopefully find that drug soon.
Hopefully. Professor Michael Parker, it has been a real pleasure and really interesting to chat with you tonight. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks very much for the opportunity.
And of course, wherever you get your podcasts from, you can subscribe to the Great Australian Lives podcast and never miss an episode. And of course, catch up on conversations with some of our incredible guests, people like Sally Warriner.
Have a look who signed it. It was signed Sally Warriner, wife of the general manager. What was I thinking?
At one point, a friend of yours had tried to use the term management team as a descriptor for the work of women on stations. The men shot that down, didn't they?
With these managers' wives, who all work really hard, as well as their husbands, couldn't we call them management team? And he said, no, they're managers' wives, and that's accolade enough.
Fergus Watts.
Investing in the young person that isn't perceived to have any obvious issues on the surface, we're not really interested in. 5 years ago, we invested 1.34% of all health funding in preventative solutions. And 5 years later, we deal with something that pushed everyone's mental capacity to the edge. We're finding out that we're not equipped to deal with it. And unless we change our view as a society, unless we change where the value is, we're going to keep reliving the same cycle.
And of course, join me next week when we celebrate another episode of Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals Celebrating Lives.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals Celebrating Lives.